Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the second weekend of March 2018. Hard to believe we're already into the third month of the year and rapidly approaching the spring equinox. This weekend, of course, is our spring forward time change, so an hour less last night, but that means an hour more daylight in the evenings for us here, an hour more darkness in the mornings, I suppose, just shifting the day a little bit later. It doesn't seem to really make that much difference here just for a short period of time, you know, with daylight increasing by about 5 minutes a day. Early risers, no doubt, will notice the dark in the morning, and many of us will notice the extended daylight hour into the evening, but before long, it'll be light for all but the earliest of risers, and staying light until, you know, well into the evening for us. So, as I said, equinox is nearly upon us, so just a week and a half away, and we'll be into the lighter half of the year. As this time of year brings a lot to it, it's herring season. I heard that they're starting to do herring aerial surveys, and birds have started to move, especially the gulls in response to that. So, it's an exciting time of year. One thing I haven't seen or heard of anybody seeing yet is any wildflowers out there. Some years by now, we have blueberries starting to bloom, or in a little warm pocket, maybe a salmonberry or two. After the exceptionally warm weather that we had in December and January, I was a little bit concerned that some of the plants might break dormancy a bit early and bloom early and then get hit by a frost. But that doesn't seem to have happened, at least not that I've noticed. So if you've seen anything out there, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. You know, I know that there's plenty of things, no end of things that I don't see, so it'd be great to hear about what's going on out there. So far, March has been a little closer to average in terms of precipitation. We did have a couple or 3 days at least of that kind of classic outflow wind, sunny, cold, not as frigid cold as it can be, but chilly weather. I was glad that the flowers weren't out because it was getting down into the 20s at night, and that might have been enough to damage the flowers. But January and February were largely fairly dry, well below average, and most of the rain that fell just on a handful of days each month. But the other interesting thing that I noticed was that most days had at least a trace of precipitation. They didn't have a lot, so we didn't have one of those classic kind of cold outflow events that extended for a week or two with blue skies and really frigid weather, but we also didn't have very wet weather, so it's kind of been an interesting winter so far. Of course, winter is winding down. The official end of astronomical winter is the spring equinox here in a little over a week. Those deep winter colds where it is clear and into the teens and lower sometimes here in Sitka, seems like those are usually, I can remember a few into the middle of March and maybe even the third week of March, but after that, just usually it seems like frosty nights and warmer days. So we're drawing close to that time, and looking at the forecast, looks like we probably shouldn't expect anything too cold. So hopefully we'll see some spring flowers soon. I know I'm looking forward to that and the many other things that I enjoy about the spring season. As I mentioned before, birds have already started to move around. This time of year, it seems like waterfowl are starting to reposition themselves. Some years by now, in warmer years, the swans have already left. They do seem to be hanging around here for at least a little while longer, but I expect in the next few weeks that they will head north. We're starting to see some different ducks show up, and whether they were wintering locally and have just started to move around locally, or whether they're coming from further south, it's hard for me to say. The other birds that seem to be more clearly moving in are the gulls, and they have started to accumulate in numbers here. It seems like what usually happens is they start staging in March, early March, and are just waiting for the herring to come in, and of course taking advantage of whenever the long line season opens, and then they have food to eat there in the channel as the effluent from the fish processors come out. So it's a good time of year to be watching for gulls. Sometimes unusual ones show up, at least if you're interested in gulls. But also the waterfowl, be a while yet before we see expect to see any songbirds really moving. But by the end of the month, should be the first of them. One thing you don't have to wait for is the songs of birds. They have already started singing, our overwintering resident birds, and well, probably some of them will move north from here, but others will stay here and nest. And on sunny days like we've had, the song sparrows I've been hearing singing, juncos have started to sing. The other day I even heard a starling imitating a hermit thrush, which was kind of novel. I've heard him imitating other calls before, but I was surprised to hear a hermit thrush singing, then paused and realized, oh no, that's a starling. So it was a first for me. Things to listen for while you're out there wandering around. The conversation I have for this week's show is with Phil Mooney. I was able to speak with him this past week. Folks in Sitka will know him as the retired fish and game biologist who worked out of Sitka here with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for over 20 years. He has a lot of great stories, and it was great to be able to chat with him this past week. You are retired from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Were you 20 years total there at Fish and
about
Game?
26.
26. So right. The last part of that is a wildlife biologist here out of Sitka. And then prior to that, it was, I think you said, Habitat Division?
Habitat Division, right.
Yeah. And did a lot of work on probably mostly large mammals, I would guess. But
mostly, I did some work with birds. Mm-hmm. And during my Forest Service career preceding that, it was kind of a mix of rodents and badgers and birds and a few other things.
Yeah.
So it was... So I kind of been cross-trained.
Yeah. So it is. I mean, I suppose that's interesting. You were telling me before we started recording here that you started your career at the Forest Service down in the Intermountain West.
Right.
Drier, I would imagine, especially in the summertime. I spent a little time there going to college and graduate school kind of in that general region and kind of explored around there. But still a lot of forested areas. And so there, I guess there's definitely some logging there, but it seemed like a lot of the logging was on private lands rather than public lands. And so maybe the issues were probably different in that area then.
We had a lot of what you would call today small sales in Wyoming on the old Bridger National Forest. It was mostly lodgepole pine. They protected as much as they could the Engelmann spruce, which was fairly uncommon. And there was some Doug fir, but it was high elevation stuff too. So you didn't have huge trees. If you got a tree that was 36 inches in diameter, that was a big tree.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, fire is a big part of the ecosystem
down
there. Yeah. And I don't know, there's been talk about, management for fire and how that has actually played into the massive fires that now occur.
It has. That's actually an interesting point because, I was still in college when I started working for the Forest Service during the summer. And at that time, and that's back in the late 60s, fire was the enemy.
Yeah.
And they attacked it. Everything was almost a paramilitary way set up to attack and defeat the fire. And midway through, probably starting into the latter part of the 70s, we had a couple people that were getting into playing around with prescribed fire. And part of that research was a biologist out of the Bridger Teton by the name of George Gruhl, who started looking at aspen clones and found out that they needed ground temperatures of around 103 degrees and above to release, so that essentially a single tree in a clone is genetically identical to everyone in that clone. You can have some huge clones that go cut for a couple acres, but the way they reproduce, they need that fire. So he actually started working with the fire manager to promote the prescribed fire. So I got in on some of the first ones and ended up got into a prescribed burning boss position with them. So I nearly changed my career. So it was interesting.
Yeah. Well, going from that to, did the Forest Service bring you up to Southeast Alaska? Is that what brought you up here to start with?
Yes. And I came up as the area biologist for the Chatham area, replacing Virgil Hinkey, I think his name was. He was injured in a helicopter crash that happened over by Sergius Narrows.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's been a few years, and it seems like then you pretty quickly shifted over to fish and game at that point.
Yeah, see, it was the thing about fish and game that I always found interesting and ironic in a lot of ways, too, is that when I got here, I was in an upper position with the Forest Service as far as being a supervisory wildlife biologist, but they were actually talking about sending me back to D.C. to work on subsistence stuff, which was very foreign to me. And I still remember responding to some of that was like, I just got here. I really didn't come here to go back to D.C. I wasn't my game plan. And funny, at the time, I had applied for this position on the Chatham and also as for the district ranger position in Cordova, and that was the year that Exxon Valdez happened.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it's like, wow, okay, so I wasn't involved with that. But Butch Young was the area biologist here at that time, And he essentially took me under my wing. I went down and introduced myself, and I really had been in a couple of places where Fish and Game and the Forest Service, and this was particularly in southern Utah, they would not communicate with one another. It was a very, very much a very bitter battle over who did what. And they didn't share data, and they didn't help each other out with projects. And after I ran into that, I made it a point to break that down while I was there. And it just had been something that got carried on for a number of years and just became the way of life. I was like, wow, that's a horrible way to do that. And here, the Forest Service has so much control over the land, and the state has that. And Butch was like, yeah, we need to work together. And that's how I got it on the deer pellet transects with Butch and Matt Kirchhoff and his brother, Mark. And it was great. Got a chance. The skipper on the boat had been around, Charlie McLeod had been around, I don't know, 40, 50 years. And so while I'm on the first trip, he's given me all the history of why this is where we came and got water. This is where we did this. There was a cannery here. There was a settlement here. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. And for folks that don't know, the deer pellet transects, I don't know if there may be some updated versions, but my understanding basically was, this was developed by Matt and I think maybe some other folks as well, but as a way to try and estimate populations of deer when you can't, I mean, they're pretty good at hiding.
Right.
The terrain that they're in, but if you do a transect and count the number of pellets, you get at least an abundance index, I suppose.
Right. And it has been revised somewhat with some better work, but at that time, prior to Butch being here, was Loyal Johnson. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they had a number of vegetation exclosures where they essentially built a wire mesh cage, and then they would go out and check the vegetation growth in that compared to what was being eaten on the outside. And they've been in use for a long time, but that went when the deer pellet stuff started, because there's always a maintenance issue of keeping that stuff
right
up.
Yeah.
So the string transect, using the same bearing, mm-hmm, would gave you some reliability, and then you had the chain, and you had the same the poop, what we call the poop string, which is the distance from the middle of that to count the pellets. So a lot of times they were 10-day trips, so 10 days out and on the boat with the same group of people. That's a great way to get a lot of history.
Yeah. Well, especially with people. I know that Matt and Mark, I think, had a lot of history down or were interested. It seems like Mark maybe wrote a book on Baranoff Island, you know,
kind of
interviews with people that had been around for a while. And I read that. They had it at the library here, and I read it. I think it's hard to come by these days. But the pellet transects, you know, I helped out it wasn't an official one, but one that was being done as part of the Blue Lake just monitoring work there. And boy, you know, following a transect through the woods, like just, okay, follow this line, not always the best way to go through the woods.
No. What looked good on an aerial photo wasn't necessarily the easiest way to get across that.
Yeah. So I imagine that, you know, did they have these transect lines set up in advance? Like, were they randomly decided, or was it based on habitat considerations and other factors?
I think they did a couple preliminary trips out to look at the vegetation and try to find the best cross-section that they could get. And then they marked it on aerial photos, went out there and ground truthed them to see, one, if they would work. And, there would be some places where you'd come up, you had a V-notch. You had to either go down it and not back up it or go around it a little bit. I think they took that into consideration, too. But you're right. There are a couple that are very tough to get through.
Yeah.
We'd roll dice
on
the, to see who got the transect. And it was like, oh, shoot, if you'd been on it once before.
Yeah.
And some of those down towards Port Alexander, they get into that brushy terrain on the south end. They're horrible.
Well, just going on the, just going through a Devil's Club patch or, you know, anything, even that, I mean, it's like, well, you know, it'd be a lot easier to just go over there, but the line goes through.
Right.
So you kind of got to crawl through and see. And sometimes you actually found pellets down in there, but it was deer can get through some stuff, I guess.
Right. It was really a good way to see the country. And plus there was a lot of fellowship as far as you teamed up with a different person each day. You got to learn a little bit. You're going to spend the day walking in the woods with them.
Yeah.
And the varied backgrounds was fascinating to me. A lot of people from back east ended up here, and I think still do.
Mm-hmm.
But they, I guess the leveling line for all of those people was that they had a very sincere, deep interest in the woods and the animals. And it wasn't, the pay was not as much a consideration as being able to do the job.
Yeah.
And that's that when you look around and you find that, you find something that you really want to do because you want to do it like that, changes everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like, you know, I've heard stories from a number of different people who's like, all I ever wanted to do was be in the woods. And Alaska kind of has that thing about it, you know, that it's this, maybe less so now that things are more connected. I don't know, but you know, back in the 70s and stuff, Alaska was still kind of frontier like in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I think
it still is too. When you talk about traveling around here on marine, mm-hmm. you know, on marine waters, that was I spent lots of times in canoes and stuff back east, and on the water like that. So water safety was good, but coming here and setting off by yourself, and maybe planning to be out there 7 to 10 days, you had to do some homework.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that's especially where it's helpful to talk to those folks that have been around,
right?
Been around the block a few times. And yeah, one of the things that I've always enjoyed about when you give talks and presentations, you're regularly referring to the folks that you had done the job before, essentially, or worked in similar fields. It seems like you've you know, as you were saying, you made the effort, seeing the opposite of that when you were first getting started down in Utah, to kind of keep those connections strong. And you know, not everybody agrees all the time,
right.
But when you're the decision maker, you know, it's helpful to have experienced input from different folks, I imagine.
And I mean, that's something that when I was in college, and I don't know how much they do it anymore either, but we never really got into classes to do conflict resolution. I mean, mm-hmm. that wasn't, they never gave you courses on that you might have to go to court and testify for this particular thing. And I think that one thing that I learned along the way was that you have a lot of people, a lot of sportsmen, sportswomen that are out there in the woods. Their observations are pretty valuable. And your job is to sort through that. I mean, your job is to be out there a lot more than they are. And to collect good information.
Yeah.
But it's there's nothing wrong that I've ever found. If they hand you pictures that I was here on this date, this is what I saw, that's valuable. You can't be the ABC Islands, Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof Islands comprise an area about the size of the state of Connecticut, and I'm the only person there. I can't be there. There were at when I first started here, I think there were about 13 communities. If you had some like Cube Cove, mm-hmm. the logging operation of groups of people scattered, there's no way. I'm based in Sitka.
Yeah,
and so Sitka's going to get the bulk of my time, but I need to plan regularly to get out there and get into some of those other communities. Part of that's driven by if you've got a bear problem,
yeah,
or you have some other thing, a project that's going on that you need to get to, and the fact that you know, you have the road system on Kruzhov, you've got a small road system over on False Island, you have one over at Corner Bay in Tenneke Inlet, and you have the Hoona Road system, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And the Hoona Road system at that time had about 400 miles of road, so you could get on. There were dead ends on
right.
each one
yeah.
of the,
yeah.
the ends, but that was a way different way of looking at it than doing it from shoreline.
Yeah.
So that was another big consideration. So, you either go by boat or you fly to it, or I would take up, load the Suburban up, throw the four-wheeler in the back, take it over and leave it in Hoona for a good portion of summer, especially when we're doing the deer work.
Yeah, I would imagine that, you know, the considerations in, of course, on the ABC Islands for deer, Yeah, I suppose bear get them opportunistically, but probably aren't a major predator on them. It's my sense of it. We don't have wolves. We don't have cougars.
Right.
So it's people and winter, and probably people in very concentrated areas, you know, near the shoreline or accessible popular hunting spots, or where you can drive in cases where that's a possibility, and then weather everywhere else.
Yeah, and then so then for me too, the another thing that was. Another piece of that puzzle that which I had never really considered significantly was the fact that you've got guides. Mm. That you've got guides on commercial operations there. So it turns out that the Forest Service cabin network is pretty important for not only the locals but also for them, because they know that they're going to have concentrations of people there that doesn't particularly help them.
Yeah.
So the dispersal, and that's why there's been the Forest Service has a shoreline analysis to try to figure out this drift back and forth between the average Joe that wants to go out there and spend a weekend with his kids versus somebody, photographers. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't particularly want to be disturbed when they're trying to get pictures. Pack Creek is a good example over in Admiralty. So they set up, you know, periods. They have a permit system over there where they actually control the number of people that come in there to see the bears and that. And the photographers take care of that, you know, view that too. It was really fun working the bears over there when we collared a few.
Yeah.
Because they were used to people.
Yeah.
They weren't, you know, it wasn't like just walking up on one here. They were curious. And there are a lot of clam bears over there. So the way we had it set up with the Forest Service is that it was pretty snaky, actually, trying to dart a bear in a what's going to be a viewing area, or what is a viewing area. And there was some concern that people would be upset seeing a bear with a collar on it or ear tags or something like that. So it was very, very strict. It's like, we're going to take one bear from this drainage. It has to be a male or it has to be a female. Well, when you're sitting in a whaler,
yeah,
and you're looking at the bear, and there were a couple of times, I swear, that we sat there and that bear would not urinate, so we couldn't tell for sure. And so being that there's a lot of clam bears out, I would get out of the boat and go pretend to dig clams, and they'd stand up and look at me, and then they'd come to push me off of the area. And that's how I was able to get so close.
So these are bears, when you're saying clam bears, they're bears that are eating clams, which I guess my impression is that it's a learned behavior that not all the bears have.
Right. It is definitely a learned behavior over in that area, and they have the right environment. They have a lot of places that they have. The funny part, though, is that with the flat tidal areas, you have to be very careful when you walk along with about a foot of water on where you can't see the hole that the bear has dug. Because it looks like a backhoe went in there to dig out a clam.
They're aggressive diggers, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. I suppose they can dig pretty fast, too,
I imagine. They can. But they'll leave a hole that's about 3 feet deep. So they're pretty persistent.
Yeah, that would go over your boots pretty quick. Well, I mean, it's been interesting. I've never noticed. I mean, there are certainly places here I can think of where I would think that it could be productive clamming for bears. But I've never heard of anybody reporting seeing bears digging up clams here, but I don't know.
We've seen them at False Island where you could sit at the cookhouse there and look out over the flat there. That's a pretty extensive one, and I've seen bears going around there digging. But on over around Pack Creek, that whole corridor right there seems to have the right conditions, and you'll see a lot of it's funny because the one day in particular, we had not darted a bear yet, and they made it very clear that this had to be specific. We could not have a bear run around with a dart hanging out of it or anything like that. So we went in there, and there was a nice male, which we had to take, right on the shoreline. And I said, drop me off. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm just going to walk right towards him. I mean, you're used to seeing people. I should be able to get close. And he goes, well, I'll back off, and I'll cover you. And this was pre-taser day. So, and that's the last thing we want to have happen, too, is have to kill a bear. That had been just a huge publicity mistake.
Yeah.
And so I'm walking up to the spare, and he's kind of looking at me like, what are you doing? And he kind of turned around and danced a little bit, and then he sat down, and I was able to get pretty close to him. And he still needed to be within 30 feet or so to put a dart in exactly where it needed to go, in his hip, not any place else. And he got up and he'd walk about 10 feet and then he'd sit down and I'd just follow him. Well, he's leading me into a nice little grove of alders. And I got about 30 feet away and I hear on the radio, it goes, I wouldn't go any further. So the next day we came back and it was getting dark, so I wasn't going to pursue him. And so the next day I was coming back and we pulled up and I said, that bear's probably still in here. He's a big male, so he probably owns the place as far as that goes. And we're watching through the binoculars, and quite a ways away, I see what I thought was somebody in hip boots face down on the edge of the creek. I go, Chad, let's go. Let's go right. There's somebody down over there. And so I jump out of the boat, and I go charging across that. And as I come up over the rise, I could only see a little bit, you know, I come over the rise. It's him. He's laying face down on his belly, his heels up, which look like a human heel. He's just sunning himself. Wow. He turned around and looked at me like, what are you doing? Like, are you lunch? But we ended up getting him. He was the first bear that we had picked up. And the whole purpose of that was to show that even though they are Pack Creek bears, what we call Pack Creek bears, regular visitors, they go well outside of the Pack Creek area.
Hmm.
They are available for hunting. And so, you know, it's interesting that they come into that area. They're smart enough to figure out that if you sit on the log, we've had bears from me to you.
Wow, yeah.
Come up and dump their cubs off right there alongside of you. They only usually allow seven people on a log that's about like a length of a telephone pole. And the bears come right up and sit alongside of you and feed and do everything else.
They understand how it works, I guess.
I guess that's it. That's it.
Huh. Yeah, it is. So as a wildlife biologist, I mean, probably a large part of your job is managing the people.
It is.
As opposed to the animals. It's understanding the animals in a way that allows you to manage the people more effectively in terms of, you know, regulations and so forth. So the collaring that you did basically gave you a track where they spent their time.
Right. The newer collars here are actually set up so they will dial your phone every couple of weeks and let you download the data. That's some of the newest ones. The other ones, they store what they're called store on board. So they collect the data for a year, year and a half, sometimes 2 years if you can stretch out the battery length. And then the collar has essentially a kitchen timer in it. You set the time and date that you want it to come off. There are two little small explosive charges in it that break a couple of springs when they hits that. And it drops off in the ground. And when it does that, it has a mortality signal, meaning if it stays motionless for a certain period of time, it changes the frequency or it changes the beat. And so you can go, oh, it's off. Either the bear is dead with the collar on or the collar's come off. And then you go in and because you've got the VHF signal from it, then you go find it.
Wherever it happens to be. I've
exactly.
heard there are some exciting outings to find.
Retrieving collars is a kick.
Yeah.
It is. It's like a mystery to be solved. Like, where is it exactly? And the goat collars are particularly challenging.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people that were tasked with the job of finding a. I think it might have been a dead goat that had died over the winter, but you know, and exceptionally rugged terrain, trying to find a way through to.
Right. And one of those that we had is that we could get the signal. And when we got there, there's a huge avalanche path.
Mm.
And we circled around a couple of times. And then we noticed a bear and with a big hole. And he goes, put us down. That's where it is.
Yeah.
That's what the bear is digging out. And sure enough, it was.
Yeah.
So wow. I think that showed us, too, that the bears are, one, that goats get killed in avalanches. And two, bears are smart enough and have the sense of smell to track them down.
To be able to find them. Yeah, I would imagine that, you know, the meat's pretty fresh, you know, and it's basically a freezer until it melts out.
Right, so. And they come out and they're hungry. They're like, hey, you know, look what Mother Nature packed for us.
nice in the cooler. So the bears, you know, I guess I'd be interested to hear a little bit more. I know, you know, my sense is that you know, males have larger territories than females and that that they do a pretty good job excluding, and females want to stay away from large males if they have cubs. But that there's just anywhere you slice it, there's a lot of bears around on the ABC Islands, and they will concentrate in places where there's food,
right,
apart from whatever other territory that they might have.
We had, when I came on board, and it was fairly early after I was the area biologist here, where two things. Most of the bear research done for the ABC Islands has been on Northeast Chichagof and Admiralty. And the only reason has been for the logistics to get from Juneau are a lot easier from there here. So as far as I know, I'm the first person that ever put a radio collar on a bear on Baranoff Island. But the researchers had put out, I think, 13 or 14 collars targeting female bears on Northeast Chich. For some reason that I can't exactly tell you why, they set the timers wrong. They were supposed to come off before they entered the dens, and they missed it by a month. And so we had essentially $200,000 worth of radio collars inside the dens.
Oh, man.
Well, it turned out to be one of the best mistakes that anybody made, because they were all adult females that had cubs. And so we had a chance in June to go in there and retrieve all of those collars. One, it gave us an amazing look of all of these bears did not dig and did not stay down. They were up high elevation, anywhere from 2,800 to 3,000 feet up. All of them were on the north face. Some of those dens were ancient. They had carried sticks and the nearest tree was a long ways away. And robin nested, and most of them were about 16 feet long.
Wow.
Had robin nested it, so there was a foot of mat in there. And so it was funny. It was kind of spooky to go into them, even in June, because they're not very high. You're on your hands and knees. Two, they were tough to get into, too. There's a little tiny path, usually on a pretty steep slope. And so you actually would edge across the rocks with your back against that until your butt hit the open hole, and then you would sit down and come into there.
Wow.
And of course, we had headlamps on to see back in there, but there would be a mound at the very end, and under the mound would be the collar. So it disturbed the bear as the charges blew, and she pushed it and buried it while she's in hibernation. But the thing fascinating about that is that all of those 13 were pretty specific as to elevation and to aspects. So the question became, is that a defining factor on what a quality habitat feature that the alpha bears have is a den site like that? And how often do they use that same den site? So you're right. And I don't know that we've answered that yet. But that could be, we have an extremely high density of bears, probably the highest known, as far as I understand, it still is the highest known in the world for brown bears. So what is that? What is that factor? And, you know, what does that mean for all the subadults that don't inherit a home range? What do they do? And from what I can see in town here, that's why we have some young bears end up digging under some places next to the Indian River subdivisions and stuff like that. It's that they don't have a place to go to, and they don't own a home range.
Yeah.
And Hugh Bevan's work, interesting with the trail cameras, is I think for a long time, there's been a lot of black bear research related to the use of rub trees as marking and also, you know, scratching poles. And it wasn't until Hugh actually started coming back with some pretty interesting trail camera stuff that we started getting interested in how important those trees are. And the best I can tell you is that up until breeding season, every bear uses that tree. It doesn't matter, young, old, female, male. Everybody's rubbing, everybody's peeing on the tree. They're telling everybody where they are. Come breeding season, and immediately afterwards, only the big males and the big females touch those trees. The pictures show the young ones coming up and gently sniffing and then backing out of there.
Hmm.
And when we were doing all the deer work on Northeast Chich, it was evident. You come by, and it'd be the same bear. She had an ear tag from 10 years ago. She's the only one using that tree.
Interesting. So when is the breeding season for the bears?
It's in about from the middle of May to the early part of June.
Okay,
short period.
Yeah, I've had trail cameras out that I set up on trees, And I don't usually get them set out that early. So I see, you know, multiple bears using them, you know, through the summer and into the fall.
Right.
You know, and just doing the kind of thing where they're, I don't always notice them peeing, but in this last summer's set that I got, there was definitely some, you know, big pot-bellied bear there laying and clearly peeing away as he was scratching his back there.
And being a pack creature, we've seen that behavior where a young guy came out of the woods, he's working the stream, and I'd say he was a three-year-old, so he's still considered a sub-adult, and he wasn't with an adult bear. The females here generally keep their young 3 to 4 years, mm-hmm. which is a fairly long time. And it came down, and it amazingly got a nice fish on the first try. And it looked like a guilty kid with his hand in a cookie jar. He ran across into the grass flat right in front of us and was eating. But he was, you know, he'd eat and then he'd pop up and look around him, and he was definitely worried. Well, there was good reason, because within about 15 minutes, we see a big adult male come out of the woods, and he's on the stream. And he came down. In the meantime, this guy stood up on his hind legs. I've got good pictures of him. He sees that bear. Spits the fish out and runs at a right angle, going away as fast as he could. Well, the big bear came down to the exact spot that he had been fishing at, stopped, scented, came straight across on a dead run to the fish. And last time I saw, he was headed on a dead run to where that little bear was running.
Yeah, wow. So will they, I mean, I know that males will kill younger bears and eat them. And I guess I've never really considered how much effort they're willing to put into that chase. Like if they get them close, I imagine it's not too hard for a big dominant bear to kill a young bear, but like if, with a head start, you know, are they gonna, you know, chase them for miles, or do you know?
I don't know. We were sitting in a pickup on our way to the Yakutat dump one day, and it was in the evening, and we'd had dinner, and we just thought we'd see what was out at the dump. And at that time, there wasn't much of fencing or anything out there. Before we were about a quarter mile away, and all of a sudden we see this bear come flying out onto the highway running right at us. So we stopped. Like, wonder what's going on there. Well, not too far behind came out a really big bear. And so in that quarter mile, that young guy was definitely running as fast as he could. And the big guy get tired. So he'd actually run pretty quick, and then he'd slow down and he'd start running, but he's still coming to us. And then he'd regain his breath and take off again. That little bear ran right into the front of our truck, looking over his shoulder.
Oh, geez.
Knocked himself down, and the last we saw is that he was still being pursued by the big bear through a neighborhood and on out. So we looked at one another and said, I wonder what he did to tick off that big bear so badly. But
yeah.
I think some of it's pretty directed, either by scent, that they catch that bear in their area. And you mentioned something else, too, that when I was in school, when you're looking at home ranges, in my mind, I always had this, you know, easy circles or squares,
right, yeah.
or like, well, it's not like that at all. And sometimes it's really difficult to figure out, you know, where that home range starts, where it ends. They know, but for us trying to figure it out, it's pretty interesting. But during the deer work in Northeast Chich, since we were out there so many days at a time, and we had two callers that were stuck on bears, had been on them for almost 8 years, that the battery was dead. And, of course, that gets to be a problem as the bear grows, right? And more so on male bears, because they get such a big neck. We finally came up on those bears, ambushed them with darts, and got those callers off. And those bears were really skittish. I mean, we'd seen one right off, like the second day we were there. Hey, there's that. There's a bear with a collar on it. We need to get her. And as soon as we got close to her, she was gone. I mean, they must have remembered that experience. They wanted nothing to do with us. After we got those off, though, those bears, and we were there for another 5 years, those bears, and there was one on either side of the creek. We never saw them cross over that boundary, and yet we had the ear tags. It was definitely those bears, which is another thing, is that people will come in and say, I saw a brown bear over here of this color. And you go, okay. And then I'll go out there and I'll say, well, I saw a brown bear was of this color. It's amazing how much the color changes as their hair grows.
Oh, so their color changes just over the course of a season?
Of a season, yeah. As the length increases, we'll have some bears in the spring that you can identify, like, oh, this is orange, you know, and this has got a white patch here.
Yeah.
Well, come August, where the hair is really starting to fill in.
Not the same.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's, of course, when we banded birds, you know, every once in a while you'll see a bird with white or something that you can identify, but it's having the color bands on them, you know, you say, oh, that's that bird,
that's,
you know,
that's right.
And it's nice to be able to do that. And it does seem like sometimes, I mean, obviously they all know each other, but the animals do, but it seems like sometimes there are bears, and that, you know, just talking to the folks down at Readout Weir that have been there for years, they're like, oh, you know,
this is who, this
they've
is who,
seen
this is the,
know,
cub
the families, yeah,
right,
yeah, and seen that. And I don't know if you have had a chance to spend enough time in kind of one place, and like you were there at Northeast Chichikov for a number of years, but to see start to see some of the, like, oh, I recognize that bear, having seen it grow up, essentially.
Well, they, when we started the taser work, and we did your original works up in Yakutat at the dump, and then once we had the prototype down, we went to Port Armstrong, and our first thing that we were tasked to do was to collar bears, so that we could say definitively that this, you know, we shot the bear with the taser. It didn't die. It didn't go off and die. And so we picked a female that had cubs of the year, and we got her down and got her collared. And so the nifty thing about that was that when we recovered the collar a year later, we could see her home range, and she had gone to Larch Bay. Mm-hmm. We, as standing around with a group of biologists, we're all betting, like, it's this peak over here that she's going to go den at, you know. Well, that wasn't the case at all. She ended up going to Larch Bay and essentially laid down in the grass with her two cubs about 150 feet off the edge of the water, never went into a den, spent 2 or 3 months there, but she was up and roaming around the beaches all the way down to the tip of Baranoff Island.
All winter?
Yeah, except for about 3 weeks where she was actually didn't move. So... after seeing that on the map, we went down there to take a look at that habitat. Well, you have all this, one, you have the warm water breeze coming in that. The grass was high in March that year. Plus you have all this flotsam of stuff coming in, marine mammals that had died and washed up. She was just scavenging.
Mm.
But on July 2nd, like clockwork, she turned and walked the 11 miles back to the weir. Almost in her exact same tracks.
Wow. Huh. I mean, yeah. I guess they have, I mean, it's clear that they have trails, you know, that I see, that they use regularly.
Right.
And you know, I remember when I was first seeing those, I was like, well, they must be there a lot. But then I realized that actually, no, if they use those all the time, they would just be mud troughs.
Right.
You know? And so those hot foot trails are things that they use regularly, but not like all the time. So when the first time I set up a camera on one of those, I was a little surprised that I hardly ever saw, you know, like over the course of a season, you know, maybe 10 bears over 3 months,
right,
and not all of them walking on the trail, you know, but that when they do walk on that trail, it seems to be in a very deliberate fashion.
Yeah, like they're headed from point A to point mm-hmm. B is what what I've seen. Yeah, it's, we were pretty concerned when we did the deer work over in Northeast Chich that you're going to be out there blowing a fawn call, and you got a lot of bears around. The bears pretty well ignored us until hunting season came around, and then something switched. So we would give up right about the first part of September. It got too dicey.
they knew when. Or they figured it out pretty quickly when hunting season started and there was food to be had.
And given that time that we had out there, we spent 7 years on that project. And we were actually up in a truck sitting watching a big meadow. We saw a doe come out and actually give birth to twin fawns, and had a brown bear come out on the other side of the meadow and walk the fringe of that and never scented that doe. And that doe actually stayed there in that, about an area about the size of this room, for 5 days before she moved those fawns.
Hmm. And would they get up and walk around at all?
They would but they would get up and essentially walk 2-3 feet maybe and nurse on her, and then she would have them lay down again, and she would not drift very far away.
Yeah.
And I assume that's to keep her scent contained. Yeah. She wouldn't be walking over to where the bear was. That would leave a trail for the bear to come back to follow. She was right there. And we saw a number of bears take that outside. It was a well-defined path for them. They were going from point A to point B. And I'm sure had they stumbled across those fawns,
yeah,
you know, they would have taken advantage of that. But
yeah, I remember speaking to Todd Brinkman about the work that he did on Prince of Wales and saying that the black bears there had learned to walk the edges of the roads looking for, because that was a nice habitat for fawning.
Right.
And they would then opportunistically, you know, intentionally, but opportunistically pick up the fawns there. And yeah, I have to think that bears here would do the same if they found them. But it's presumably the deer knew that the bears used the other side there and that she was reasonably safe as long as she stayed still.
It's an interesting dynamic. So, I mean, I have to admit that I can probably honestly say that I don't think I've ever gone to the woods and not learned something new, seen something different. Working the bears at night with a FLIR camera, we see behavior that we had never seen during the daylight. And I think that's just because they're more comfortable. You don't have people interfering with what's going on. It's fascinating. And every time we do the goat work, you get up on Baranoff and you see a whole different group of birds up there that you don't see here in town. You're a very short distance away.
Yeah. Well, and there's plenty, you know, that's one of the things that I've been, you know, there's the trails around town, the established trails, your Verstovia, your Gavin Hill, Harbor Mountain, and you see stuff there. And it's easy to imagine that you're seeing the alpine, but really none of those trails get very far above alpine, you know, above tree line. You know, there's a little bit above tree line. And so when you go a little further back country, but even not necessarily that far, Stargavin Ridge has a number of plants that I've seen there that I didn't see on along the trail system. Or Bear Mountain, you know, you get up there above 3,300 feet and it's a different zone and there's quite a few different species of plants up there and birds as well, you know, the rock ptarmigan hanging out up high there, rosy finches. And it seems like you talked about seeing peregrine falcons,
right.
You know, on kind of the high peaks of Baranoff Island that, you know, they nest on Lazaria or out on the cliffs and stuff out there, but we don't usually think of them as being associated with the
right. The peregrines really surprised me. The numbers of them that you see and actually it's surprising how much bird traffic there is over the top of that. That when you're flying in a helicopter, you really appreciate it because you see the ptarmigan and they flare up and then you because when they dart, they usually dump me out,
yeah,
because they don't need my weight when they're coming in with the small bell helicopter. And I got smart after being dumped out a couple of times and I'm sitting where I can't see anything. It's like, okay, put me on that ridge so I could shoot pictures of the helicopter doing it and also look around at what was going on. And I was fascinated at the different plants and a short distance and a short change in elevation that we had, which kind of led me to the belief that the north end of Baranoff is way, way different than the south end. You've got some key plants that you'll find, but you have a much different overall change as the further north you go here. And I think part of it's related to soils.
Yeah. Yeah, the geology, and I mean, I'm sure that there's climate differences as well, but also the geology and, you know, just Dan Evans and Eric Speck's trip, and I remember Dan talking about their first year headed south, you know, and he'd done a lot of hiking, you know, around Sitka and kind of the north end, but heading south out of Salmon Lake and just discovering that between there and Whale Bay that there are things that on the map, you know, what he was used to would have been no problem. But
right.
down there was a lot more cliffs. It was just, you know, the way that the rock weathers and
right.
Shapes is different.
It's rough country.
Yeah.
You're right. I one of the first boat trips I did up at the end of Whale Bay got into that. I didn't expect to have the brush to the fact that I couldn't hardly get through it, you know. And we found some spots on Admiralty that were like that coming out on the big tide flats that you're just not going to walk through it easily.
Yeah.
So that diversity and change that you have in short distances is always pretty fascinating. And why it happens and how it happens is kind of the key to trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of those large lakes on South Baranof, and you know, I've only been on Rezanov Lake and the lake Vostov Lake, I think, right below that. But just, you know, Rezanov Lake's at 800 feet, and then the valley above that's brought, there's these open meadows, you know, just very different looking than I'm used to seeing. And then to think, oh, well, that's 800 feet, you know, it isn't even at sea level at that point. You know, so that was something that was kind of fascinating, just about the terrain. But also, you know, my brother spent some time looking around just up above Benjamin and talked about finding, well, look, I think he says it just looked like the bear denned underneath a tree. Like, you know, you kind of get the root spread there,
right.
And they just went under there. And
that was pretty common to see. If you go to Yakutat and you get into all the moraines on the big flat area, that's where. We had one lake up there that we actually talked the loggers out of taking the trees out of there because there were 7 bear dens on one little lake. And it was obviously a pretty key place for them to go. And so it was weird in a way to come from here and be expecting a more formal dens rather than just taking advantage of. Now, these were dug out, but they took advantage of root wads and stuff and carving out from that. But and probably some of it has to do with the water table too. A lot of those were robin nested, meaning they, you know, they'd carried in material there and lined them.
Oh, up in Yakutat?
Yeah.
Out of Yakutat?
Yeah, Yakutat and ICB.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it is, and I imagine as, you know, snow piles up, the, you know, stuff will seep in. And so it's kind of fascinating. It sounded like you did not expect the ones that you found up out of, on Northeast Chichikov, the females, with cubs that were denning on the north aspects, you know, high elevation. That is, you know, maybe are the. Did you ever find out if they're doing something similar? Well, obviously the one that
well,
spent the winter in Larch Bay didn't. But
to me, the first thing that kind of came to mind is, well, you can only have so many peaks around here
right.
that are going to have that. So that's a limiting factor right there. So, and we knew that all the bears that we had collared were adults with cubs. So. We have never had a research bear younger than 7 that's produced cubs. So that means the bear has got to be 8, 9. And that's kind of the break for us has been the 9-year-olds are where they've got the size, they've got the knowledge now that they can go on there. And where the female cubs may inherit part of the female's home range, the male cubs do not. They are on their own completely. And so... So the question that would come to mind is like, oh, do one of these cubs, will they end up inheriting this?
Well, and how old does it, I mean, how many sets of cubs does a female typically
produce?
Well,
you're not going to, usually we would have, if you figure 3 to 4 years, they keep them, and then they would usually take a 1-year break or to a 2-year break and then have another set. So if you had an average age of, say, 26, which is starting to get pretty old, there's some research out there that shows after 20, you know, that the rate of producing cubs goes down. We also know that the density here, you mentioned earlier on about male bears, is pretty well known that they will kill cubs. But at Port Armstrong, we actually have video of female bears taking another bear's cubs and killing it and eating it.
Wow.
And it's got to be a social pressure when you have 30, 35 bears that are piling into the weir. And the bear that lost her cubs was a newbie.
Mm.
And yet the next day they were right together again like nothing happened.
Hmm. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, bears mostly seem fairly solitary. But, you know, obviously they have these social interactions when they're all gathered together. And yeah, it's interesting to think about. So if I'm doing the math right there, then essentially, you know, you might expect a single female, the most productive females, to maybe have 3 sets of cubs.
Right.
And
we have, you know, that we've had 1 or 2 bears documented with 5 cubs. And we've had a few more documented with 4. But 3 is a pretty good.
And so 3 at a time, or
3 at a time,
and then so then from those, you know, over time, then they would have. Do they have them all in the same year typically, or they?
Yeah, they would have all those. You know, they would have 3 cubs born at the same
time. And so then they would have in three different, you know, if they keep them 3 to 4 years, have another year,
right,
and have another set. So their sets, they might have 3 or 4 sets in their lifetime.
Exactly.
And of those, survival rates, I'm guessing, are not that high. But it's hard to say, maybe.
Yeah, I think that they have a fairly high mortality rate.
Yeah.
And especially, and that's actually a roundabout way of kind of getting to what we were trying to do with, if you kill a bear DLP, especially if it's a female, usually you're told to euthanize the cubs. There's not places to put them. They aren't adopted by another bear. And boy, after you've killed a lot of those cubs, it's like there's got to be a better way.
Yeah.
It's just, it seems like, I know a bunch of them don't make it. We've tried. We put Wolverine collars on a couple cubs, got them till they were about 70 pounds, and then without much human interaction, and turned them loose. And the longest one lived was 6 weeks.
Mm. And killed by other bears?
Killed by another bear.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I imagine that, you know, they don't know where to go. And it seems like there's a lot of social learning that happens, you know, in the feeding strategies.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And all of that.
They rely a lot on their parents, you know, their parent as the sow, yeah, to teach them. But, and it was what we tried to do is, you know, knowing that would be a situation is we tried to pick an area. We went to the hunting records and looked for an area that had some recent bear activity of that year that took out some big males, hoping that there would be a slack period. I'm not sure there's a slack, yeah, period.
Somebody's always waiting.
Somebody's waiting to step into, yeah, you know, in the wings, waiting to go into that area. So,
yeah, it would be fascinating. I mean, I guess the best, it's sort of an artificial situation, I suppose, when they concentrate around a weir at a hatchery or something
it
like
is.
That. You get a little bit of a sense of the social dynamics there.
You do, and there's definitely, and we can talk about this, you know, in more detail at another time, but that is probably one of the most fascinating things we've learned with the taser work, where you're spending a lot of time there, sometimes 6-7 days at a time, and you're looking at the same group of bears.
Yeah.
You have outliers that come in, but you have a lot of subadults. As you cannot keep a bear from food. You can train it to how to get to the food and how, you know, avoid, and that's what we try to do down there, is you can't be in the work area, can't be on the boardwalk ever, and can't go into the residential areas. So you can train them to stay out of those areas, but they're still going to go there. And then the thing you have no control over is if you have 5 bears there, the social issues that they have between themselves, one goes after another, that bear could care less if you're standing there. It's going to run from, it knows what will happen if it gets caught.
Yeah.
And so in that situation, you got to have the patience to let that bear get the heck out of there. That's,
yeah,
all it wants to do.
Well, it'd be fascinating to hear more about that, and I know that you need to get going here today. But yeah, it's been great to talk to you. I'd be interested. Is there anything else you'd like to share here just before we wrap up?
Most people know me. No, I've got a lot of stories, but and it's been, like I said, it's always been a learning experience, and I feel like I really had an opportunity that that I always hoped I would get.
Yeah.
So thank you for the,
yeah,
opportunity.
Well, and I appreciate you being willing to come in and share your stories, and look forward to maybe hearing a little bit more about what you're learning with bear social lives. And I know we barely talked about deer and goats, and I know you spent a lot of time with them as well. So, yeah, it'd be fun to have you back again. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Phil Mooney. He's a retired wildlife biologist who worked for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game based out of Sitka for over 20 years. I want to thank him for taking some time out of his schedule to come visit with me, and thank you for listening this week. As always, you can find recordings of past shows on sitkanature.org/raven, or hop on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there, where I also post links to these recordings of past shows. As our daylight is rapidly increasing and we approach the spring equinox, birds have started to move, and I'm sure that plants will be blooming soon, and maybe some already have if there's a warm little pocket. I haven't seen any myself, but if you have, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. You can reach me there, and whatever you're seeing, I'm interested in hearing about it. If you got questions and have a picture or a recording, it's great. Or if you just have a story, I'd love to hear about it. So please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, just after the spring equinox. So into the light half of the year. I'm looking forward to the spring and summer to come. And so until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCW, Sitka.